Thank you for joining us for an episode of Cholangio Heroes, a video podcast produced by the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation. I'm Jennifer Weaver, and I will be the host of this episode that features our guest speaker, Dr. Ryan Fields. He is the chief of surgical oncology, I believe, at Washington University, correct?
Yep, you got it.
Oh, right on. But you also have a special connection to the foundation, and I was wondering if you could tell us the background about how that came about.
Sure. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be involved with the foundation many years ago at an invitation of a colleague out to the Cholangiocarcinoma Summit in Salt Lake City, and so got to know the foundation. And then at Washington University, as part of a research program, became involved in an effort that really was kind of the intersection of both patient clinical care and research, but also working with patients and their caregivers as advocates and partners in research. And so we proposed a big research project that, frankly, we couldn't do without the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation that involves them as research partners.
Well, and I love that it involves directly patients and caregivers to get their input. So from that connection, what kind of came about from that? I understand that you got some funding.
Yeah, so this was all part of the Cancer Moonshot program. As many people know, the Cancer Moonshot started back during the Obama administration, had analogies to the Moonshot program, or going to the moon program, of President Kennedy. And the real challenge was to substantially decrease the death rate from all cancers by 2030. And that was sort of the charge. And then President Obama put then Vice President Joe Biden in charge of it. As many people know, Joe Biden's son had died of a brain tumor. Joe Biden was very involved in cancer progress and research. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was about $1 billion. So, of course, the first thing they had to do was they had this big pile of money. They had to figure out how to do it, how to use it. And so they assembled a blue ribbon panel of experts around the country and identified different priority areas. One of the key priority areas was called the Participant Engagement and Cancer Genome Sequencing Effort. So it's a mouthful, but basically, the observation was that many clinical trials, but especially clinical trials that involve cancer genome sequencing, were heavily, heavily weighted towards people that frankly look like me, middle to older age white males, even though these cancers affected minorities, affected females, affected younger and older people. And so we were making a lot of decisions about how to treat cancers based on one particular demographic and that may not be applicable to everyone else. And so there was really an effort to say, well, let's try to increase participation in trials. Let's try to understand how and why people say yes and no to participating in trials. As the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation, as you know, trials are the key to progress. So Right. There has to be that trust and there has to be broad representation. So they were interested in studying rare and understudied cancers, which of course cholangiocarcinoma falls into. And so what we proposed to do was to study a really large number, thousands of patients with cholangiocarcinoma, and understand both how and why people participate in clinical research, try to optimize the processes by which we approach and identify and consent patients. And then if we return results to patients and participants, how meaningful is that to them? Do they get a sense of not only is it helping them, but could it be helping others? How can we steward that better? And so rather than just accrue patients here at WashU, which although at St. Louis at Siteman Cancer Center, we have a big cholangiocarcinoma program, mm-hmm. we wanted much broader representation. So we approached the foundation and said, hey, could you guys partner with us as we launch this to try to help identify, recruit, approach patients, form focus groups at the meeting, try to see how we're doing, and just iteratively refine this process. So I know that was a mouthful, a long-winded answer, but we're really co-investigators and partners on this. I mean, Melinda Bikini serves on our patient advisory board, is a member of the research team, is on all of our meetings. So it really is a true partnership.
So we have probably a diversity of people who will watch this video podcast as well as listen to it. If there is somebody out there that had a loved one with cholangiocarcinoma, which is bile duct cancer, for those who may not know who's joining us, or they may be going through it themselves, how would they get connected to this?
Yeah, so it's exciting. There are multiple ways to do it. The podcast is timely because we really are just launching the patient recruitment phase of this now. We're basically in kind of, I don't want to call it a test phase, but we're sort of this first week or two of identifying some patients in St. Louis at WashU to just test the informatics, the process. But next week, there will be a launch on the cholangiocarcinoma foundation website and social media things going out with how you can participate. But basically, if you send an email, and this will be on there, to PECGS, that's the acronym for that Participant Engagement Cancer Genome Sequencing Mouthful, but PECGS at wustl.edu, that'll sort of get the ball rolling. There'll also be a phone number and a webpage you can go to instead of just sending an email. And then we have a clinical research coordinator named Hassani, and we have a research nurse named Danielle, and they're going to be the ones who would then be contacting patients, telling them a little bit more about it, getting them the consent documents, and really getting the ball rolling. The two things that I would point out is participation in this research project does not involve any more visits to the doctor, any biopsies, any blood tests, anything like that. We utilize the biopsies or the surgery specimens that patients have had in the past, and we request those from the hospitals and the pathology labs, and that's what we use to study things. So the rest of it is really phone-based or web-based interviews and gathering of medical records, that sort of thing.
Well, that's nice. So I'm in Utah, and you're obviously not. So the way that you've got this set up, anybody can participate. Does that include people outside of the United States? Because we have a lot of people in Canada that are very engaged with the foundation.
Yeah, we think so. There's maybe just a little bit of red tape on our end to deal with just because it's a federally funded grant. But because we're doing all the work here, it shouldn't matter that patients are outside of the U.S. because, again, their records will be gathered by us and the biopsy specimens would be at no cost to the patients or participants, shipped to us, and then we return them back. So yeah, so long as we can navigate that part of it, I don't think that'll be an issue at all.
Oh, this is wonderful. So everybody has an opportunity to advance research, and your target number is 1,000 patients?
Roughly. We don't really have a cap other than the sort of budget, but there's sort of an economy of scale, meaning the more patients we have, the less expensive each of the sequencing projects and things cost. So we're sort of looking at around 1,000, but it could potentially be more than that. And I think we'd be, if we were really had the overwhelming numbers of patients that were tipping that scale, we'd probably go and figure out how to drum up some more funds to keep it going, because that would just be a fantastic, I don't even want to call it problem, a fantastic issue to face. It would be a great opportunity.
Right. So once you've got, you know, people participating, mm-hmm. what kind of data, you mentioned getting their records, but what is it on the research side that you're going to be looking for?
So we're going to do a couple things. The first is we'll be doing probably one of the deepest dives into the molecular biology, the immunology, the genomics and genetics of cholangiocarcinoma. So as many people know, we know some of the what I'll call low-hanging fruit now about cholangiocarcinoma, meaning there's things like FGFR mutations in a percentage of patients and IDH1 mutations. But can we now, with some of the real cutting-edge techniques of single cell sequencing and looking at the tumor microenvironment, I think we're going to be able to even better understand cholangiocarcinoma with the hope of uncovering some new targets and therapeutic angles. And because we're going to do it in so many patients, we'll be able to really understand, hey, is this particular to one subset of cholangiocarcinoma? Is it more prevalent in certain populations? So that's one big part of it, really a deeper understanding of the biology of cholangiocarcinoma. But what we also hope to really understand is the process of consenting and accruing patients to clinical research. Meaning, is there a barrier that we just don't understand when we approach certain people or populations that makes people say no, that makes people say yes? And again, is part of that what patients feel like they're getting out of research? Meaning, are they if they sign up for a study and they never hear anything about it, does that sort of make them less likely to say yes to the next study? So we really want to return results to patients, engage them in the research process, and then really try to refine that and improve that. So for example, if we found that, hey, the way we're approaching patients is just not at a good, not the right timing, not the right language, then we're going to try to improve that. And the way we're going to study that is with some really, really detailed social science type research with focused interviews and surveys to study that process.
Do you think that perhaps the fear of participating in these type of trials is that their information is not safe or secure? They're sharing it. And I mean, yeah. I know that might be fear of mine, because a lot of technology now can be hacked. So what safeguards do you have?
Yeah, so I do think that is, you know, one of, when people have done research, especially in cancer genomics, that there is some level of mistrust, whether it's of the healthcare system in general, or that, again, there's going to be some data breach. So, you know, not unlike a large bank, you know, there's a huge amount of focus on security of healthcare medical records. So whether you're using a platform like Epic or any other platform, or where all that data is stored at a place like WashU or Siteman, is behind, you know, massive firewalls and protection, things like that. Importantly, when a patient participates in this, they're, you know, given a, basically generated a random number, and all the data that may be moved around even internally at WashU is de-identified, in the sense mm-hmm. that it doesn't have any information that can go back to identify a particular patient. But I think one of the things we hope to address is, if we find that mistrust is a big issue, then maybe we're just not doing a good job of really conveying how the data is stored and used, and the protections that we're doing, and then, of course, the potential benefit.
Well, I think one big way that we can invoke some trust is through you. Could you tell a little bit about your background? Because I think you leading this project, if people get to know you a little bit better, yeah. that will help build, you know, build any type of mistrust. We can dispel any myths or anything of that nature.
Yeah, and what I'll say first off is, although I'm one of the leads of the project, this is a big project. So there's multiple leads at WashU, mm-hmm. multiple, it's what we call a multi-principal investigator, multi-PI grant, led by people across the spectrum of cancer researchers, both on the clinical and translational side, but also public health sciences and cancer genomics. I sort of came back home to St. Louis, if you call it that. I did my residency here and met my wife here in St. Louis, and then went away for fellowship to New York to Sloan Kettering for a few years, and then came back. And I've been on the faculty about 10 years. My wife is an elementary school teacher who's actually in the process of getting her health coaching certification degree from Duke University right now. And we're lucky, my wife's parents are in St. Louis, and I have two young kids, a 14-year-old son named Gabe and a 11-year-old daughter named Sarah, who are doing well. And actually, they, as I was saying before we started, they love their cholangiocarcinoma foundation swag. My daughter's running around in that green sweatshirt and hoodie all the time now. And I'm fortunate because we're part of a really cool multidisciplinary team of surgeons and medical oncologists and radiation oncologists and cancer psychologists and support staff. Our nurse, Emily Hemmer, traveled with us recently to the cholangiocarcinoma summit meeting, where she was recognized as the Nurse of the Year award, which she was thrilled. And we just are part of a great team that, whether it's cholangiocarcinoma or different solid tumors, is really fortunate to play a role in making a dent in progress here.
So where did your passion come from to get into this line of work?
We go back a little ways. When I was in college, my mom was diagnosed with an early stage of breast cancer, and I became somewhat fascinated with, I was interested in biology and maybe medicine at the time, but really got drawn into the research side of things because there were so many questions. There were good treatment options, but still so many questions of, okay, what do you do next? I remember she was faced with the decision of whether or not to do chemotherapy afterwards, and there was just not a lot of great data, although people were studying it. So I got involved in a research lab and then became very interested in the surgical field, mainly because of the way surgeons interacted with their patients, that very sort of special bond, and then the ability to do really interesting research with the partnership of our patients and the ability to study the tissues that we were operating on and better understand the biology of these tumors. And I guess, as they say, the rest is history, but was fortunate to train under some great mentors and at some great places.
Well, it sounds like you actually have a very personal touch in always keeping the patient first in mind. And so I'm very grateful for that. Is there anything else that I've missed that you would like people to know? Maybe say that email address one more time.
Sure. It's PECGS, which is, again, for Participant Engagement and Cancer Genome Sequencing. So PECGS@WUSTL.edu, which stands for Washington University in St. Louis. And we're going to be sending out a lot of information about that with the help of the foundation, that'll be coming out with, again, with the webpage, with phone numbers to call. And If all else fails, it's very easy to Google my name and you get a link to our webpage at Wash U. So if you just put in Ryan Fields and Wash U, you'll see our webpage and easy to contact us really anyway. So even if my assistant gets a call through the clinical appointment number, she knows where to sort of put people through when they're looking for information about research studies.
Well, wonderful. Thank you again for joining us, Dr. Fields. Everyone else listening, please go to our website if you'd like more information. Obviously, we'll have information forthcoming with this wonderful project. And you can find us at cholangiocarcinoma.org. I know it's a mouthful, but you can also find us at curecc.org. It's a little bit easier to kind of navigate the internet to find the Cholangiocarcinoma Foundation. Thank you again, Dr. Fields. And please join us next week, everyone, for another episode of Cholangio Heroes.